Ladies and gentlemen, I've got a list in front of me. I can't even read this. Love of the loved. Anyone who had a heart. You're my world. It's for you. You've lost that loving feeling. I'm not going on with this list. She's a legend. She's a star. I am delighted at last, a one-to-one with Miss Cilla Black. Hello.
Oh, Peter, what a build-up. Thank you very much.
What a build-up. I'm just adding up how much you made out of all these.
I did. Well, actually, I didn't make a great deal, you know, because in those days I was just grateful to get a record contract. Yeah. So the residuals, Bobby made all the money because he had all the B-sides on those records.
It's amazing that. Explain how that works, Cilla, because people don't realise that side of it. If you do a B-side, you get the money.
Well, if you write a song, you earn much more money. Because I tell you why. Because my manager at the time, which was Brian Epstein, the gorgeous Brian Epstein, had invested an awful lot of money in me. And the record company does too. But they've got to have faith in you that you're going to earn some. So you might be selling 100,000 records per day. But at the end of the day, they're going to take out what they've invested in you. And quite rightly so, because they're taking a punt. They're betting on you that you're going to be a success. Bobby didn't take a punt. He just wrote the songs. So he got all the money. I was a kept woman in those days, Peter.
You know what you say about taking a punt? I don't think people realise how many records actually fail, and managers and agencies and record companies lose a great deal of money.
Yes, they do. It's all about, you know, it's a gamble. It really is a gamble. And, you know, you read all these astronomical fees that they pay Robbie Williams, for instance, but they wouldn't have paid him that much money without getting a little bit back.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it goes. I think so today, but certainly in my day, that's the way it worked.
Who is Cilla Black? Who is Cilla?
Well, what you see is what you get, really. I mean, on stage is where I'm happiest. I'm at my happiest. I'm much so relaxed out there. And nobody can take anything away from me once I'm on the stage. You know, because I'm in my own world. I mean, you've got to remember, Pete, I've wanted to do this since I was 3 years of age. So, you know, to actually be on any stage didn't have to be Liverpool, although, I knew I was halfway there because I was in my own hometown. But on any stage, no one can touch me. That's not a big edit thing. It's like I'm in my own world and I'm doing my own thing. And that's what I love best.
But if you hadn't got that confidence, you say about big edit thing, it's not. But if you didn't have that confidence, you wouldn't be where you are today, would you? You'd be a shriveling violet.
I don't know, Pete, because, you know, it's the only thing I've known.
That's what I'm saying. It's not a big-headed thing. It's the fact that it's you. You are Cilla. It's that driving force. It's like, we'll talk about television later, but when you were doing live television, there ain't many people in this world can do live television.
Actually, I love live television. Mm. It's the best because you know why? You go on there, you make your mistakes, and you get off and you go home. I mean, if it's recorded, you know, they can edit the whole thing to suit what they think is going to make a good show. So I love live television and I'm very comfortable with it because I will make mistakes. And I think, oh, I've made a mistake, maybe two, maybe three. But it's live television and that's what it's all about.
Let's go back to when you were a young girl, before you were a teenager. What was life like? Tell us a typical day at home.
Well, I was brought up on Scotty Road and I lived behind a barber shop, George Murray's, 380 Scotland Road, and next door to a Chinese laundry.
Wow.
And in those days, you know, my father was a docker and my mother had a stall in the market in St. John's on Scotty Road as well, because you know Scotty Road is a very very long road. Dual carriageway.
With many pubs in those days.
Oh, pub on every corner. My dad's pub was Fitzy's. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I went back last year and I couldn't find where I lived, it was all knocked down. And I thought, oh, my God, there's the... Oh, I think it was the pub. I think it was called the Parrot. I probably am very wrong, but I recognised where I live because of the pub on the opposite side of the road. And I thought, oh, but yeah, look, yes, it was very more than working class. But I didn't know I was poor because everybody else was in the same position and everybody helped each other and no doors, no thieves, no nothing. No doors were closed or locked or anything like that. And we were all working class people. You know, my street that I used to play in was Bostock Street because the street where my front door was off of a back entry, you know, and my mother used to always dream of having her own front door. And I remember one day and she was crying on the staircase and I said, well, what's up? I'd come home from school. What's up? She said, oh. She was hoping for a council flat, you know, to have her own front door. And I thought, oh, you know, if I make it, that's the first thing I'm going to buy, a house. And did she complain? Yes. Why? Because there was not a bus stop outside.
She got a front door, but no bus stop.
She got a front door, a detached house up there in, oh, God, off of Queen's Driveway. And but she complained till the day she died. There's no bus stop.
Can you tell me the excitement of planning to buy her that house?
Oh, no question. That's all that I strive for, really. You can't imagine it until you've been there. You know, to come home from school and to see your mother crying on a staircase, it's not good. And that's always stuck in my mind. So the question is, there's no question. The minute I had a few bob, that's what my mother was going to have, her own front door. But then she missed everything from Scotty Road. Obviously she would. Because all her mates, she was the president of the Catholic Mothers Union. It was all that. I mean, I was doing, you know, I was recapturing, I guess, my youth and seeing her crying that, you know, the council didn't think that she deserved, you know, her own council house. And that really, really upset me. And so in a way, I was doing a bad thing because I took her away from all her friends and my father. Actually, my father took to it like a duck takes to water. He loved it there. He did love it. In Woolton. It was in Woolton, a posh house in Woolton. A new one, a detached house with front garden and back garden, you know, with lovely, what do they call them, those glass doors that go out on the garden?
Patio doors.
Yeah, patio doors and everything. Well, you know, for someone who'd never had a front door, yeah. I thought she would love it. Mm. But the only complaint she did have was that it never had a bus stop outside.
Can you explain the love for your mum?
Oh, well, but I was daddy's girl, you know, both my parents. You know, you're brought up the way you're brought up. And I've tried to bring my children up the way my family brought me up, really. There was so much love, so much laughter. My mother was a great singer. I told the story on the Piers Morgan show that, you know, one kid thought that, you know, they were paying me. Well, it was bullying, really. Oh, you think you can sing? You're not a patch on your mother. Mm. And I thought that was a fabulous compliment to me.
Yeah,
that really was because, you know, both for me mother's singing. You know, I remember Monday morning, God, and, you know, those old-fashioned sinks, doing all the washing. I'd been to the wash house, Burroughs wash house, with her, you know, and, you know, it was in the days. I mean, it sounds really awful now. Or, you know, you won't believe it now. But Me mother used to have a bundle on her head and balance the
really?
Bundle. Yes.
Wow.
Yes, and a lot of people did that. Well, there was a lot of washing, so the only way to balance the bundle was on the head.
Wow.
And then we all went to the wash all overs at Burroughs Baths, you know, once a week. Because, you know, it was fabulous. It was the, it was either that, when you outgrow, the, you know, the tin bath in front of the fire. And remember, I had three brothers. So, I, you know, it was once I got old enough, I could go to Burroughs Bath. I got the money to go to Burroughs Bath once a week.
How did they cope with your fame, Sarah?
Well, very easy, really. I remember going home. I was at the Palladium and I'd had two number ones, you know, Anyone Out of Heart and You're My World. And I used to go home after 13 shows a week at the Palladium just to go home for, you know, me mum's dinner, you know, roast beef or roast, you know, if you could have roast beef. Roast chicken. Oh, she did an amazing stuffed heart, ox heart. Oh, gosh. And I love offal today.
Tell me again what it's called, a stuffed what?
A stuffed heart.
Heart, oh, right, fine.
Oh, fabulous.
You do make me laugh. Go on.
No, but this is true.
I know.
I travel through the night after doing three shows on a Saturday to go home, you know, just for me Sunday dinner.
Yeah.
And I got home one day. Well, first of all, in the morning, I sat in my dad's chair. And, you know, that was terrible. You know, you don't sit in your dad's chair. And but I did. I was a star. I've got two number ones, you know. What can I tell you?
It's my chair. I paid for it.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, that chair I didn't. He just looked at me when he came back from the pub and he just looked at me and then he said, "Hey, you, up." And I knew I'd just, you know, so, and but that wasn't the finish. We had our dinner and then my mum was going down to bingo. My dad went to the pub. And consequently, you know, Sunday night at the London Palladium was on. I was left in the house. I'd travelled all the way from London and it was a 7-hour journey in those days because you didn't have, you know, the roadways, you know, the motorways that you've got now. And I was left with our lassie watching Sunday night Pat Boone.
Pat Boone.
On the Sunday night at the London Palladium on my own with our lassie. And if, when you say, how did it affect them, that's how it affected them. I wasn't going to interrupt their life, basically.
Did you ever think that you were going to be on the Palladium top of the bill? Yes. The word yes.
Yes, I know. I'm trying to be.
No, be yourself. Be yourself. Yes, I did.
I am trying to be. No, you're right, Pete. You know me too well. Yeah, my sights were high. It's like when people say to me today when I do interviews, if you went on The X Factor, do you think you would have done? I said, I would have won it hands down. You know, that's the way you have to think, though.
Yeah.
Well, if you know me, that's the way you have to think. And I do have, as you know, I do have my quiet moments. I do have my shy moments. But if I'm on stage, that's where I shine.
I tell you what I really want to sort out now, and I'm really glad we're doing this programme because we're going to break a myth once and for all. Now, people that do knock you, if anybody does knock you, will say, but why did she leave Liverpool? Now, I'm going to give you the chance to answer, but I'll tell you what I think, and I'm sure I'm right. Your agent, your manager, who is a powerful man, would say that you would have to go to London anyway because the industry was there. Anna, you just said a 7-hour drive. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but let's put this myth to bed. Why do you live down south?
Well, for all the reasons that you've said there, and not only look, Pete, I remember Bobby driving down from Liverpool. I was doing a recording on the Monday and I had the best session I ever had, actually, where I, because you had to do three songs at a time, and one of them was Sing a Rainbow, which was quite big for me. In fact, a lot of people thought it was a single, but it wasn't. It was on an album called Sing a Rainbow. And it was Thick Fog. You don't get that these days. But Bobby said it took him 12 hours to drive. And I had a morning session. I went straight from the car into the recording studio at EMI. It's not like it is today. And I gave one of my best performances, I think, on Sing a Rainbow. But we followed a lorry with and their tail lights, because Bobby said, you know, a lorry, it's a big, you know, a big car, they can't go wrong. But this one did. And it was right into roadworks. I mean, this is what I did for my art. I did this and it took millions of hours to get there. And you know what? I did one of the best performances. Of course I didn't want to leave Liverpool. Of course. Why do you think I went home after 13 performances every Sunday to have me Sunday dinner? It was just the way. It was the way. And you've got to remember also, and that same show I was talking about, the Palladium, where I did, it was 9 months. Brian Epstein signed. I'm not making excuses here. I'm so not making excuses here. He signed for the run of the contract. And I was only 13 shows a week, only on 350 quid a week. And I had to provide my own dresses, my own makeup and everything. And he said to me, Brian, I love Brian, he said, oh, don't worry, you know, Charlie Drake's, his show only lasted 4 weeks. Because I actually said to Brian, why couldn't you have got me the Liverpool Empire? And anyway, the thing is, he honoured the contract and I've always honoured my contracts. And I was there for 9 months. So by that time, and in all that time, I stayed in a hotel. Brian wanted to get me a flat. And I said, I don't live here. I don't know the people. You've got to remember, in London, it's where I was, the Palladium, that is not the real London. It wasn't until I did Ready, Steady, Go with Cathy McGowan. And, you know, we were both two good Catholic girls, went to church every Sunday. And we became great friends. It wasn't until I was invited to her house, and it was in Streatham, that I thought, God, this is the real London. I like this. This is where I like. The West End, you could be talking to anybody in the street.
Yeah.
It's too cosmopolitan. But it went on from there. 9 months went into 18 months and then went on. Just went on. What can I say? If I was starting out today, I probably would never, ever have left Liverpool, because you can now have a recording studio in your own front room. Mm-hmm. You couldn't then. You had to go to EMI. You had to go where the work was. And that's what I did.
In those early days in London, were you lonely and unhappy at all?
I wasn't lonely and unhappy because I had the Beatles, I had the Foremost, I had Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, and also I was working. You know, that was the love of my life. You know, I was working most of the time. Well, all of the time, actually. So, no, I wasn't lonely. I was happy because I was working.
You mentioned Cathy and Ready, Steady, Go. How important is your religion in your life?
Well, it was really, really very important until, you know, Bobby got ill. And I just thought, there is so not a God out there. Because, you know, I'm talking to him now, but every night, every single night, Bobby used to laugh at me. I used to pray and thank God, you know, and then I'd talk to him and I'd say, oh, thanks for doing this. Why have you made me the lucky one? And I said, oh, no, don't answer that. And Bobby used to kill himself laughing. He said, who are you talking to? I said, I'm talking to God. But then Bobby got ill and I fell out with him, in a word. Fell out with God. I thought, what kind of a... Because he'd had Bobby had such a dreadful childhood. He lost his mother at 11. He lost his brother when his brother was 21 to cancer. And I just thought, I actually thought when I was with him, I would be the one to go first because I had the charmed life. I had the happy childhood. I had my mum and dad. I had my three brothers, and I've still got my three brothers, thank God, whoever you are. And then for this to happen to Bobby, I just thought it was the cruelest thing because I thought it should have been me.
How did you meet Bobby?
Oh, actually, I thought it was when Liverpool was then a very big port. I was 16, 16 and a half, almost, well, probably 17. Let's say I was 17. And it was in a coffee bar in a basement, a club called the Zodiac Club, which was really, there was millions of them in those days. You didn't need a license because you only sell coffee. And guess who was behind serving? And because I worked every hour that God sent me in Liverpool. On a Saturday, I used to work in Nanette's. In my lunch break, I was at an office job. And in my lunch break, I used to work in the cavern, hanging the coats up. And on a Saturday, I was a workaholic. Anyway, in the Zodiac in the evening, I saw this gorgeous guy with white blonde hair and a suntan. I thought, Norwegian, off the boats. Gotta have a few bob. And I thought, in between coffees, I'm going to work the room. And I did. I did. I literally did.
But I can see you doing it. I can see you doing it.
And, you know, got chatting and everything. And he was great. And he said, can I give you a lift home? I thought, well, a lift home. I found out he wasn't Norwegian, obviously. He wasn't off the boats. But I thought he had money because nobody in those days had a suntan in Liverpool.
Right.
They didn't. You know, who could afford to go abroad? Anyway, outside was, I'm not very good on cars, but there was an impressive car outside and he took me home and I thought, God, he's got money. He's from Liverpool. He's got money and he's interested. And then I found out at the end of the day, he told me he'd gone on one of those all-in paid-in holidays to Lloret de Mar and it was 48 quid all-in. You know, the flights, all the food, the hotel.
They had planes in those days.
They did. And I'd never been abroad. I'd never been abroad. No, I'd never been abroad till I was at the London Palladium on my day off when Fab 208 magazine wanted to photograph me in Paris. And that's the first time I'd been abroad. And I was professional then. But that's how I met Bobby, in the Zodiac Club, in a coffee club, thinking he had money, didn't have anything, apart from, you know, it was baker and confectioner, actually. He worked at Woolies. He did all the Madeira cake. His Madeira cake had won prizes.
Oh, right. Oh, well, now you see. It was worth doing the show just to find that out. Tell me, when you got to talk to him, did you find out how he felt the first time he saw you?
Well, he lied about his age because I liked the older man, you know, the 21-year-old. And he told me he was 21 and I was 17. And I course, you know, to a 17-year-old, that is quite old, 21. Anyway, he was 19. I should have known then, shouldn't I? No, but we just clicked and we had our ups and downs, more fights than anything. He never came to my 18th birthday party. Which all the Beatles came and everything. Because, you know, by then I was singing in the evening as well with the big three or singing with anybody who will have me, actually. But it was a long up and down kind of thing, a lot of rowing, but it was meant to be. He was my soulmate.
What I love when you talk about Bobby, there is a glow, it touches other people. There is a smile on your face. and you've lost him, but he is with you every moment of every day, isn't he?
Oh, all the time. And I tell you what, Pete, because you never met him, did you?
I met him once. I met him
really?
Once. Yeah, I was pushed away from you by him.
That's my Bobby.
I was one of those scorned.
Well, I remember, I love people who knew Bobby,
mm-hmm.
and I love them when they talk about him, and it's great because, you know, it's a great conversation, and I just sit back and listen to, because they all have their stories. Even Savage, Paul O'Grady, has got his story, and it's absolutely true. Both of us were doing the Michael Parkinson show. Now, I'd not seen Savage out of the drag, you know, out of all the gear.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no towels in my bathroom, you know, your dressing room. And Bobby, I said, oh, there's no towels in here, Bobby. And Bobby took care of everything and asked for towels. There was a guy outside the door, whatever. And then there was a knock on the door and I didn't know, but I just heard the voice. I just burst out laughing because Bobby answered the door and I heard this voice saying, here's your towels. Where do you want them? And Bobby said, it's fine. I'll take them from here. I said, that's never Lily Savage, is it? And that's the first meeting that Bobby had with Lily, you know. And if I tell you, he stayed in my room and normally Bobby would never allow this. He stayed in my room with my makeup going on, me getting dressed and everything. Bobby absolutely adored Paul. And I love it when Paul tells that story because I sit back and think, you know, but for that. And then when we went on, we were still yapping together, so much so that Michael Parkinson said, can I have my show back now, please?
I remember that. I remember that meeting and I remember that show distinctly because, of course, Savage used to do the most incredible routine about you on the stage.
I know,
as
it was
Lily.
Awful. He apologised profusely.
And do you know what it was? Is it? Do you like? Because
I know he told me it was about surprise, surprise.
It's surprise, surprise. And you've got to stand behind the door with a chip pan full of our fat. And when she comes through, there, I must go, come on, Sarah, and straighten. It was terrible, but very funny.
Well, I know. I knew all this, but that's not, you
but
know.
But that was love. That
Lily.
Was love. Yeah, that was love.
No,
too.
That was Lily. You know, he did that as the character. God, you can't get a wedge between us now. We're so, so close. I had a party, it was supposed to be a dinner party for Peter Brown, who's also from Liverpool. He's up there now, I think. I said, well, who do you want? Because, you know, it was his do. And he'd come home from America. And he said, oh, well, I've got to have Savage. Well, I'm cursing Peter Brown because Paul never left till 4 o'clock in the morning. It was only supposed to be heavy hors d'oeuvres and champagne.
And that was a lunchtime, wasn't it?
No. Oh, God, it seemed like forever. But did we rabbit? It was wonderful.
Tell me, we'll talk about Peter in a moment, but while we're staying with Bobby, do you think that Bobby overprotected you, looking back? Or do you think he ever made any mistakes over that?
No, he just knew what I was like.
Oh, right.
He would never, ever allow me to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning. No. He was, no, I couldn't never say. He wasn't overprotective. No, he was totally right. You've got to remember in those days, I was working 24/7. I don't do that as much today. So I've got a little bit more freedom. I don't think you'd approve of what I do today at all. But I think he's up there laughing at me, thinking, well, go for it then. You know, you're going to get your comeuppance one day. No, he wasn't overprotective.
And what about Bobby and you as parents? Because you were, and it was something I never thought about until I heard you on Piers, you were the original first ever modern mother. I never thought about it like that. And you were castigated in some papers over it.
Yeah.
But in fact, all you were doing is what every single mother does these days.
Absolutely. I think because I had a lot of flack in those days, because it was the norm. To stay at home with your baby. And I did try, honestly, I did try. You know, I planned to take 6 months off, and that was the plan. You know, I want to bond with my baby. But I knew, Bobby knew there was something wrong when I was in the kitchen wearing an evening gown feeding the baby. You know, I just had incredible withdrawal symptoms. And I got a lot of flack for that. But then I was happy working. And most of my work then, you've got to remember, it wasn't on the road. I was doing television. I was doing the Scylla shows. So my work, and I remember, you know, because nannies have to have their days off, rushing home in my lunch hour and feeding the baby. I mean, I jiggled like mums do today. That's what I did. I just happened to be in show business. But I did it. You know, I did it. And I, you know, Robert, especially Robert, because he was my first. He never suffered. He's
a lovely,
lovely
young man. He's a lovely young man who's become an incredible family man who's put all his values into his family that you taught him.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very proud. And he's here with me today. Not in the studio, but he's outside. I'm sure he's listening to every word. But he's given me two great-grandchildren, which what I missed out. Actually, I got with Jack. I mean, I gave up the business at one stage. I did still do bits and pieces, but I gave up television because what I'd missed, I mean, the worst thing that any mother can go through is when you're on the other, again, the contract thing, when you're on the other side of the world. Mm. And by the way, I've still got my nanny working with, she's part of the family, Penny. She was the nanny. Now she's my housekeeper.
Wow.
But there's nothing worse in the world when she says he's taken his first steps today and you know you've got to go on stage. And I was in turmoil. I was in bits. You know, I should have been there, you know, to witness that. Mm. And when I had Jack, my third son, I thought, I want to do all that. And I did. It was great. It was absolutely, it was so important for me to be there for that. So I did all that. I did. I can honestly say I have been a good mum, at least to our Jack.
Scylla, did Brian get annoyed at all when he kept getting pregnant? Because managers are quite strange over things like that.
I went to him because I said, look, the only thing, apart from my career, what I wanted to do was to get married and have children. And I wanted six children, actually. I just wanted a big family. And he, at the beginning, because he did say this with John Lennon and Cynthia Lennon, and that's why it was a secret for over a year. I could have been more about Julian. It wasn't allowed to come out in the press. The media was not like what it is today, which they would have found out 2 minutes flat.
Yeah.
And then there was one day I went to Brian, I said, you know, I'm ready. And if the public can't take me getting married and, well, maybe not get, because I was married at that time or just about married. I said, I'm going to have, you know, it, when Brian passed on, actually, it was passed down to NEMS Enterprises. And I just about had enough because I thought, you know, I'm approaching 24. I know it's a baby, it's a baby age, but you know, my girlfriends had all had children in Liverpool, and you know, I was married and I wanted to have, you know, a baby. But NEMS Enterprises, the company, including Peter Brown, said, you know, you might lose your public. You won't be a pop singer anymore, blah, blah. I said, no, the time has come. And I got married and I fell pregnant right away. And boom, I was even more popular because I was normal. Mm. You know, I was a normal person that got married and had a baby. And my career went from strength to strength. So I advise anybody, any young person, and nay, I say this, Cheryl Cole, if she wants a baby, have it now, sweetheart, because they'll even love you even more.
How did the public react when you lost your child?
It was very quiet. Bobby made sure it was very quiet. Yes, the public did know, but we didn't do any of those, what you do in Hello magazine or stuff like that. We just, you know, it was a very private affair.
While we're talking about sad things, and I was going to say get this out of the way, but it's not get out of the way because he's the most important man in your life. Bobby, when you lost Bobby, how did you cope with the public funeral? Because that, after meeting you and knowing you now and how private you are, that must have been a dreadful thing for you to deal with, not only losing Bobby, but that public funeral.
I was in a daze, actually.
So you were oblivious to what was going on around you?
I was totally in a daze. Yes, I was very... I was... You know what? The people that turned up for his funeral, all his peers, everybody in television, and I'm not talking in front of the camera, I'm talking about people behind the heads of television. You know, we had Lord John Burt, we had Greg Dyke, we had Michael, who used to do, you know, produce. Every producer, every head of television came to pay homage, homage to Bobby. And that made me really proud because they all loved him. He was a hard man, hard businessman. I remember coming home and actually telling me off because I was, you know, laughing. And he'd come home from redoing my contract, I think, with LWT. And obviously he'd had a hard time. And, you know, I thought, oh, I'm Cilla Black. He said, you're not Cilla Black. I've had to sell you like a box of Tide washing up powder today. And I'm a box of Tide. What do you mean, a box of Tide? He said, I've had to sell you. I've had to sell you and to say how wonderful you are. Well, I am wonderful, you know. And I was making a joke of it. He said, you don't understand. You are a commodity. You are a saleable product. That's all you are in their eyes. And that's when it hit home to me. Because I thought, oh, everybody loves me. And I thought, God, he had to sell me like a packet of Tide. And, you know, I'm not deriding, you know, the soap powder for that. But, you know, do you get what I'm getting
I know exactly what you mean. I've got to tell you.
I was a product.
Have you seen how successful Tide's been around the world? We hear you talking about Brian Epstein. He's world famous. But we hear you talking an awful lot about Peter Brown. Who is he?
Well, Peter Brown originally started, I mean, he's always been in my life. To go back to the original story, he hates this. He's from Bevington. He's over the water, so he's not even Scouse. But he used to work in John Lewis's in the record department. And those were the days when you used to have a booth, you know, to go in.
Would
you
listen to the music, yeah.
Yeah. So I was singing in the clubs and there was Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. And they had Why Do Fools Fall in Love? And that was the song I wanted to sing that evening. And so I went into the booth and he actually refutes this. But he was in a brown overall, you know, restocking all these LPs.
Yes.
And I said, could I have, you know, could I listen to Frankie Lyman, The Teenagers, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Go in the booth and I'm trying to take the words down. Because I knew the song, but I couldn't remember the words. And then three times I did this. And he had to come back down the ladder from restocking. And he threw me out, actually, after the third. Are you going to buy the record or what? Which I couldn't afford to buy. So he threw me out. Threw me out at John Lewis's store. And it went on, well, I thought, when Brian Epstein discovered me in the Blue Angel. Because I did an audition for him before that, of course, in the Majestic Ballroom. And I just walked off the stage and straight out, got the next ferry home because I was dreadful. But then I met him again with Brian Epstein. I thought, oh, no, he's going to badmouth me. Brian wanted to manage me. And the next time I met him, he was with Peter Brown. And I thought, oh, please, God, don't let him recognize me. But of course, once you met me, who could forget me? But then I took to him like a duck takes the water. He came to London. He was great. He was just then he was Brian's PA. And of course, you know the history. He's immortalized in one of John Lennon's songs because he arranged John Lennon and Yoko's wedding in Gibraltar. And the song eludes me at the minute. But
he lives in New York now.
He lives in New York. He's got his own PR company. It's a very big company worldwide called Brown Lloyd James. Very posh.
Very posh.
And when I go, when I go to New York, I stay with him. Well. I stay with him. I have that many friends all over the world. I actually do not stay. And I don't know what it is to stay in a hotel.
There's many, many things in your life that change your life. The day Brian died, 32 years old, was a huge. Were you, apart from the fact losing a wonderful man who you cared for, were you also a little bit scared, thinking, where am I going to go now?
Actually, I was dreadful. When I did the same thing with Bobby when Bobby died. And I gather it's a normal thing now. When I first heard that Brian had died, I was in Portugal at the time, and I immediately thought of myself, you know, what's going to happen to me? And that's the first thought, and I've regretted that ever since. But then when Bobby died, I thought the same thing. Mm. What am I going to do?
Well, if it's any consolation, when my mum died, I said that was the first thing that I said. Who's going to wash for me? Who's going to look after me? And it is, as you said, a natural reaction that an awful lot of people do.
But I didn't know that at the time. I just felt how selfish. How the first thing, how could you? The first thing that you think about is yourself. Mm. You know, what am I going to do now? And it was all, and I had the very same feeling when Bobby died. You know, who's going to look after me? It's the worst thing. It's the worst thing.
Cilla Black, you made television history and decided to resign live on television. That was an incredible... That's a piece of television history, that. I'd love to have been in the boss's house. That's where I'd like to have been sitting. What was the reaction like when you came off the set?
Well, it was chaos. It was total chaos. For a start, when I said it, I could see the audience in slow motion saying, did she really say that? What did she say? Did she say that? Did she really say that? And in the ad break, you know, because we do have ad breaks like what you see on television, we literally go to a break. Everybody came down from the production team. The whole team came down. Oh, you want to retract this? I said, no, you know, I don't want... it's true. I couldn't think of any other way of handing in me notice.
Yeah. It was very dramatic and totally OTT.
OTT, but I couldn't think of any other way out. I knew I was coming to the end of my contract and I knew... they were going to offer me another 2-year thing. And it goes deeper than that. I mean, you try. I mean, I'd gone through all blind date through Bobby's illness. And, you know, he used to have that seat that he used to sit in. And you go in that dressing room week in and week out, and he's not there. And I just thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think it's the best thing I've ever done. It's not the most professional thing I've ever done, But I think it was the best. It was right for me at the time.
Tell me, what does the word diva mean to you?
Because I have no idea.
Used and bandied about. Would you say you were?
I know I would never ever call myself. I don't deserve the honour to be called a diva. Now, in my eyes, a diva is Shirley Bassey, is Barbara Streisand, people like that. Me, no, I don't think I'm a diva. I would certainly not class myself in their class at all. They are classless, or I'm classless. I've got no class.
I have a list of television shows here. I don't know. Billy Cotton, Morecambe and Wise, Burt Bacharach, Silla's Own Special, Seaside Special, The Basil Brush Show, Tarby and Friends. I mean, it's unbelievable. Are you? If I name one, would you ever say, I forgot about that? Because you've done so many. Do you get like that at all? Or do you remember them all?
No, all the ones that you reamed off, I totally remember. Yeah, especially Basil Brush. I mean, have you ever sung with a puppet before?
No. No.
Well, it's not to be forgotten. And I had to go all the way to Birmingham for that.
To sing with a puppet?
Yeah, to sing with Basil. Yeah. When I do my work, it is an occasion. I'm so thrilled. But you know, when I did Liverpool, the only thing I loved, because it was hard work for us. I mean, much more harder for you because you had to dash off every night, every other night. And when we did, I'd go out in the lash a couple of nights. And we enjoyed it then. But my best time ever was on the stage.
Why do you think O'Grady, Biggins, Dale Winton, why do you think you have this incredible affinity with them? Why is this bond? You've got a lot of friends. I've just mentioned. Why do you think this happens?
I don't know. You know, the best business to be in, you know this, Peter. This is all for the benefit of your listeners. But the best business to be in is this business. It really is. Because you make a lot of friends. I can honestly say I don't have any enemies. Now, when I lost Bobby, all those people, the above mentioned that you mentioned, Biggins, there was Dale, there was Paul, and no doubt if I'd have known you then, you'd have been there for me. Mm-hmm. But they got me out of my shell. They made me go out. And I did. You know, it was... They were my friends, and they were my friends before, and they're still my friends today. And to this day, they're still looking after me. Mm. You know, they're still looking after me. But they just all happen to be in show business.
Yeah.
And when something goes wrong in your life, and it will, Peter, it will, in a bad way, I have to say, because it happens to all of us. This is the best business to be in. For that to happen, because everybody gathers round you. And I don't know what I would have done without Paul, without Dale, or Biggins.
Yeah. You've got to mention somebody else. We're talking about friends. Your face lights up every time you talk about Patty. Tell us about Patty.
You're talking about LA Patty? There's a lot of Patty.
Oh, is there? No, LA Patty. Is that Patty Panza?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, you've not met Pat.
No, but I've heard you talk so fondly about her.
Well, Elsie will probably be listening to this. Her sister, all our families all live in Liverpool or over the water. And certainly Elsie lives in Liverpool, her older sister. Well, I went to school, basically, with Pat. Or Paddy, as she's known in America. Her husband calls her Paddy. He speaks like John Wayne.
Oh, right.
Paddy. Yeah, he does. Oh, well, she looked after my children when I had, you know, the nanny went off at the weekends. She was just part of the family. And she was almost 40. I'll tell you, this is a true story about Pat. She used to come to all the TV shows and just arrange my life. She's an arranger. She was in the record business, you know, where she came down to Liverpool. When I came to London, she came to London, worked for Polydor Records. and then was a member of the family. You know, I mean, it was Bobby who coined the phrase, not Diana. There's three people in this marriage. It was me, Pat, and Bobby.
Wow.
Because she was always there. And then all of a sudden, after Bobby used to take everybody out after surprise, surprise. And she laid a big surprise, surprise, because not to me, to Bobby. And Bobby was telling a story because, you know, he's an incredible raconteur. And he was in the middle of a story. And Pat said, Bobby, I'm getting married. Will you give me away? He said, gladly, and continue with the story. And it was me, a bit like, you know, me saying, I'm not doing blind date anymore. And I went, what? You get married? And Bobby said, shut up, I'm going to finish this story. And then went back to Pat when he finished the story. He said, you get married? You want me to give you away? He said, my God, you're nearly 40, woman. And then she said, hit me with another bombshell. And I'm going to live in America. And he's 28. And I thought, my God, this lucky person. Not only is she getting married, not only is she going to live in America, but she's got a 28-year-old. But yeah, she did marry. And they've just celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary.
That's great.
But she's
to have a friend
everything.
Like that. Yeah, it's great
well,
to have a friend like that.
Everything to
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that's the only reason. All my boys have never gone for a blonde or a redhead.
I've purposely kept away from all the television. You've been rediscovered over and over and over again, which we'll talk about in a second. Before we do, I'm going to ask you the hardest question I could possibly think of.
Oh, my God.
To really throw one at you that you wouldn't expect. You ready for this?
Yeah.
What was the first ever glass of champagne you ever tasted?
Oh, and I hated it, actually. I actually didn't have a drink till my 21st birthday.
Wow.
And that was when I celebrated. Brian Epstein took me out to lunch. The Beatles came to the Mirabelle. And, yes, it was there. I had my first glass and I didn't like it.
The first time I ever saw you, Cilla Black, was ever was at the YMCA in Hoylake, and you got up and sang Fever with the Big Three.
God, I remember that too. I remember it so well because I thought I was being abducted in the van because I'd never been to Hoylake before, and I thought it's such a long journey. I'd only ever done, you know, like clubs like the Zodiac and stuff like that in Liverpool. I told the story to Sin Lennon, and she's from Hoylake, and I've never been back since.
If you were to come into the industry now, would you be sad at the way the industry's gone?
I don't know. Being as ambitious as I am and always was, still ambitious, I don't know. I would have taken every avenue that was open to me. You know, I love competition. A lot of people, especially, you know, comics in our business, I remember Frankie Howard saying he didn't like following anybody that went down well because he thought, I'm not going to go down as well. Well, I'm just the opposite. I love it if you kill him. You know why? Because it makes my job easier. I'm going to ride on your crest of the wave. And would I? I think the avenues, there's so many avenues open today. It's the thing, it's the longevity of it. Are you going to stay? I mean, once you've made that success, you have to really work. Now the real work starts. When you've made a success, it's being up there, it's staying up there that counts. And you really have to work a million times harder than what you did getting there.
I will leave you on the pantomime in Liverpool and I will leave you on the stage. And I remember one night standing there watching you after saying to me, do you want a standing ovation or not tonight?
Because I didn't really work that hard in the matinee, did I? And you asked me, you said, what have you done wrong? You haven't had a standing ovation. I said, oh, please, the place is full of little kids. I said, you want a standing ovation? I'll show you a standing ovation.
And you got me one. You got me one.
I did. I worked. But you know what? That was good for me. That was good. It showed I was slacking up and being a bit lazy, maybe. And that was good. It was a bit like having notes, you know, when a director, you come off stage and they said, oh, you know, you could have played it better. Or at a football match, you know, a manager saying in the interval, you know, go for it. Really do this, that and the other. And that was, I took my note from you. That's when I said to you, you want a standing ovation? Okay, you're getting one.
Are you pleased that you've been reinvented? I mean, everything, all this product that's going out is doing incredible. You've got a dance song out. It's just incredible that you've been yet again reinvented.
Well, do you know what, Peter? I'm incredibly flattered. I mean, you know, this is why I prayed every night to God. Why has not the bubble burst? Why isn't it going anywhere? Why can't I just have a quiet life? I'm anything but quiet. I'm just incredibly flattered.
Wherever we go when we leave this earth, there's going to be a lot of people up there waiting for you, your mum, your dad, your daughter, Bobby and Brian, and they're only the ones we know about.
Yeah.
What do you want people to say when you've gone?
That she was talented, you know. I know a lot of it is probably down to me personality, but I hope they think I was, you know, there was a bit of talent there on the way, that she was talented.